Thank you. First, I thought I'd begin by giving a congratulations to Donna Strickland.
She's not personal responsibility for that. Yeah.
Right. I'm assuming it must be very big news here, and big news all throughout Canada, and also in the fact that it's only the third woman to win the Nobel Prize. The last woman to win was 1963. So I was actually a postdoc in San Diego in the late 90s. And the building there was named after her. And in fact, the seminar room had her Nobel medal in it. So it was always locked and you could only get in there for the talk and then you were ushered out.
Is that where she did the work?
She did, yes, yes. In fact, just to show you how things were back then, here's the announcement of a local San Diego paper when she won the Nobel Prize. SD Mother wins Nobel Physics Prize. Isn't that ridiculous? Yeah. I remember Julius telling me that. So here's the what I want to talk to you about today. Basically, I want to show you how we are doing a certain kind of calculations. We're actually able now to evaluate decay widths of hadron resonances using lattice QCD, which is kind of bizarre because we necessarily do our calculations in finite volume. So how are we going to get out information about decays? So I'll spend a lot of time talking about this Lucier formalism, because I'm assuming here we do have two lattice people in the crowd, amazingly, but I figured there'd be nobody from lattice here. So you probably aren't familiar with this. And then I'll show you then how we get what we need to get the decay widths. We have to evaluate two particle energies in finite volume. And so I'll go into a little bit about how you can do that with lattice QCD techniques, and then I'll show you the kinds of things we've calculated recently.
Are you going to be talking about strong decays or weak decays?
Strong decays, yes. So here's just a dramatis personae of the people involved in what I'm doing, and I have to thank the people that give me money and also computer time. So I thought I'd just start by giving you a little example. First of all, what do resonances look like if you're in finite volume? Because you don't have resonances in finite volume. So what can you see? So I thought I'd illustrate this with just a very simple quantum mechanical example. Let's start with a particle in a central potential that looks like this. So I've designed it so that I can get some bound states, but I'll also have some resonances. So if you solve that Hamiltonian, here's basically what the spectrum looks like. So here's the S wave states. So I get two bound states. And then I'm showing here a resonance mass. And this is another resonance mass with its width. And of course, there's a continuum of states above that. And this is then the P wave. And you can have lots of fun going to the D wave and even get to an H wave. I wonder what this symbol should be. You can go even higher than that. And here's what the scattering phase shifts look like. So this is the S wave scattering phase shift. So you can see the presence of a resonance there. And the P wave getting some more structure. So you can really control this even more. So what does it look like now if you solve that Hamiltonian in finite volume? So this is a plot of all the energy levels you get as a function of the box size, so L cubed box. So for any particular L, you go up here, you're just getting a series of discrete energy levels, right? Momentum's quantized, you're in finite volume. So basically you're just seeing the stationary states in a box. So really to see the presence of a resonance, so I kind of indicated where these resonances would be. So these are bound states. You sort of have to scan in L, in box size, and then you'll see sort of these sort of avoided level crossings. So if you look at this, you're seeing energies going down because momentum It's getting denser and denser. You see momentum getting denser over here. But you see that there's some structure to the spectrum as a function of L near these resonances.
Could you see the presence of resonance by forming like a wave packet inside the
Could you do a wave packet in finite volume?
Right, and send it, right? I can still send it, right?
It would scatter off this potential, but again, you would only see these discrete levels evolving. You've got to fix the scattering waves. They have to satisfy all the right boundary conditions.
Of course.
Yeah, so it's quite difficult.
Well, I can still form a wave packet moving to the left and impacting the potential, right? So that,
right.
I was just wondering if one could do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was the spectrum in a particular symmetry channel. So again, if you're working in a cubic volume with periodic boundary conditions, you don't have continuous rotational symmetry anymore, even in the continuum. You've got all these mirror states and so on, and so it's not a full rotational symmetry. So you can't utilize JPC in the usual way to label your states, so you have to label them by the symmetries that are allowed in this cubic box. I'll discuss that a little bit more here, but this is a symmetry A1G that would include the spin 0 states, but also the spin 4 states. So that's the A1, and the G is even parity. And here's what it would look like in another one of the symmetry channels, the T1U. So the T1 channel contains spin 1, but also spin 3, and the U is for odd parity. So again, for a particular L, you're seeing this large number of discrete states. So the question is, how are we going to get out the information that we want, the infinite volume of resonance decay information? So it looks challenging. And it is. So basically, it comes back to around the mid-80s when Martin Luscher wrote a series of papers that really was very much ahead of his time. I'll be going through in some detail his method here, but sort of recast by these people in 2005. But basically, he found a way of relating the infinite volume scattering information to these finite volume energies. It's not simple. And back then, it was just, that's kind of nice to know. But it was nothing we could really use in lattice QCD because we couldn't evaluate the finite volume energies that we needed at that time. And that's what's changed over time since around this time here. We started to be able to do that and to actually utilize this formalism.
Is that Bryce DeWitt who did that in 56? Or who was it DeWitt?
Bryce DeWitt, yeah.
It was Bryce.
He actually related, he used spherical volumes. So he found a relationship between infinite volume and scattering phase shifts to the kind of energies you could get in a sphere. Whereas Luscher then, we utilize cubic boundary conditions more in lattice QCD, so he worked away at, I mean, this is much easier. This is much harder. But this is what we need. And it's been general. These first calculations here were done not in full generality, but they have been generalized more recently to arbitrary spin, multiple channels, and so on. And in fact, these all work in two particle states. You have to stay below 3 and 4 particle thresholds. But people are now working on going to 3 and 4 particle threshold. I just want to make sure I'm not going to clobber you with this. I grew up playing hockey, so once I get one of these in my hand, I get a little bit more aggressive than I normally am.
You're going to keep your head up while you're talking. Right? I don't want to pick you out.
Right. But if I hear a noise behind me, I react suddenly. So how do you get this relationship? Now, it's very complicated, so I'm only going to give you the brushstrokes of it. Let's look at a correlator of some operator that can create two particle states. So let's call that sigma. And we're going to look at this correlator in a finite volume. That's what this L indicates here. So we created it some time, and then what I'm showing here are the propagators for the individual particles that this thing can decay to. And this box, for now, indicate that we're evaluating these propagators in finite volume. So we will have momentum sums there, not integrals over momentum, and then your annihilation term. So this would be the leading piece. And you would have other diagrams where these two particles could propagate, and then they could self-interact. And so this is sort of all the other diagrams that would be involved other than these kind. It's a beta saltpeter kernel, so it involves these kind of diagrams. And so you get a whole chain of these things. Now, if you're looking at this in infinite volume, you'll get branch cuts, of course, where two particle thresholds begin. But because of the momentum quantization in finite volume, what you're going to get are a series of these poles. So we expect this finite volume correlator to have these two particle energy poles. And that's going to be the thing that we're going to be able to measure in our lattice QCD calculations. We'll be able to get these energies in a particular way. But what we want to do now is find a way of relating them to this infinite volume scattering.
What are the green lines? You have the two particles with the black and the blue. And the blobs are the self-energies, I guess. And what's the green? In the kernel, there's some green dotted lines.
These would be the exchanges of other particles, any other particles, other than the black and the blue guys. So you take a look at this finite momentum summation in this finite volume two-particle propagation. And we're going to write it in terms of the infinite volume one that we can handle, and then plus a correction. So really what we're after is this correction here. And if you take those diagrams and just redefine a few things, so take sigma at the endpoint and a whole bunch of series on the left-hand side and absorb that into something called A. And similarly on the right-hand side, absorb these certain diagrams to call this A prime. And then take this series of the kernel, and you'll see that this is the invariant scattering amplitude, and restructure things. Then that correlator we had before takes this form. So in fact, what we can look at is the difference of the finite volume correlator with the infinite volume one. I'll call that the subtracted correlator. It has this expression in terms of diagrams. So it looks like a geometric sum, which you sum up. And so basically, the poles that you get in the subtracted are the poles that you were after from the finite volume. And they come from wherever this determinant goes to zero. So you've got 1 minus, so this is our invariant scattering amplitude. And then you're left with this other matrix here. So the goal here then is to get the expression for this F. So you get that expression for F by looking at things like this. So if you ever have a sum over the finite allowed P, the quantized P in finite volume, of some quantity here that's, say, smooth and regular. As L becomes large, this just goes to the continuum integration. And you'll make some error, of course. They aren't quite the same. But the error you make, you can prove, will be exponentially small. M will be sort of the lowest mass allowed. These kind of corrections we're going to neglect in all of our calculations. We're going to assume we're working in finite volume, but L is large enough so that m times l here is typically 5 or 6 or something, and it's very small, we can neglect. So the corrections we're after are not coming from these kinds of things, but we have to be careful to avoid those errors.
Is m set by the lightest particles in the
right.
game?
Right, yes.
So if it's rho to 2 pi and the pions are in massless, then the m is not.
Right, our pions aren't massless.
Yeah, it's true.
If you have something in that subtracted coordinate that looks like this, so you're summing over your quantized momenta, you've got a smooth function up top, but you've got something like that coming from a propagator, of course, then we can write this basically, you take the residue at these poles, and then this leftover piece is smooth at that point, that can become you can take the limit to that becoming an integral. And then, of course, you make, in doing this piece, you make this little error here. But we're not going to worry about that. So clearly, this piece has the correction we're really after. So we're going to, the method basically goes through all these diagrams and picks out in this F pieces coming from here. So it's kind of complicated. But when you do that, here will be the expression you get. So it's kind of long and complicated, so you'll have to take their word for it. And I've worked through and proved it. Had great fun doing that for a month or two. So again, we're working in L cubed volume with periodic boundary conditions. Let this capital P denote the total momentum of your system. So it'll be in terms of 2 pi over L times some vector of integers. We're going to be, from our lattice simulations, calculating the allowed lab frame energies of these two particle interacting states. So that's these are the things we're going to get from our simulation. So how are they related then to this infinite volume scattering phase shift? Well, it's this series of equations here. We boost to the center of mass frame. That's very easy to do. Here's my gamma. Let's assume I have ND decay channels. These M1, M2 sub A's are the individual particle masses in each decay channel, and these would be the spins of particles 1 and 2 in these decay channels. So I can define these quantities. So base. It's kind of like a center of mass relative momentum, but of course it isn't. Just basically taking these E's, getting these ECMs, you can define this as a particular quantity. And from these Q's, this is just a dimension, just making it dimensionless. We'll need this vector here. You find that the relationship is given by this determinant. So this S here would be your standard S matrix that has all your scattering phase shift information. So all this gives you is this complicated matrix F, which depends on the total momentum of your system. So this F matrix in this basis has this yucky form, bunch of Clebsch-Gordons, and you get down to this W function, which is given here in terms of these awful things. The only thing left not defined here are these zeta functions, some more Clebsch-Gordonry. So a lot of it is in terms of these zeta functions, which are then defined on the next slide here. So this is just a huge sum involving over these integer vectors, some little pieces here left over from just the S wave. So it's this yucky, messy bit. So thankfully, we can just let the computer evaluate this. You code it up, you take a couple of weeks to make sure it works. This is in terms of a whole bunch of yucky things involved. But once you've got this coded up, then you go back in, you can formulate that entire F matrix. So it's just all very complicated functions, but it's just functions that you know. So it's basically encapsulating how you can fit these waves into a cubic box to satisfy the boundary conditions. So basically, that quantization condition, that determinant vanishing, tells us how one single energy that you would measure in the lab frame relates to the entire S matrix. Of course, that's not something you can solve. I mean, it is if you're in a single channel and you have a single wave, then you can solve that determinant. It's just, it's not a determinant anymore. It's just basic single thing. And once you know E, you plug that into all those formulas, and out will come that S in that one channel. But if you've got more than one channel and more than one partial wave, as you will most of the time, clearly you cannot solve that for the S matrix. So you have to do what experimentalists do. You parameterize the S matrix. Well, how many parameters can it take to describe what I think the scattering should do? And then you have to basically get a whole series of these different energies and then basically do a fit to determine what parameters will create an S matrix that's giving me all the zeros that I'm finding in that quantization condition. Now, to make the quantization condition a little more manageable, we introduced the K matrix. K matrix is introduced in this way. It's a Hermitian matrix. Being Hermitian, if you plug it in here, you will automatically get a unitary S matrix. So it's much easier to parameterize a Hermitian matrix than a unitary matrix. And it'll, in fact, give us a nicer form for the quantization condition as well. So that's the first step. Let's utilize the K matrix. So in this basis, J, total spin, or total angular momentum, this is the projection of the total angular momentum onto some axis. The orbital angular momentum, the total spin, and then the channel number, so the A and the A primes are different channels. This K matrix will take this form, so it's diagonal in the J's, diagonal in the MJ's, but then off diagonal in the other components, and under parity. So you can say a lot about the form of this K matrix. You also know there's something called the effective range expansion. So you look up from the early 1930s or something, there's an effective range expansion for multi-channels. So you basically are pulling out these crucial factors, and then what's left over is quite smooth. So this thing is much easier to parameterize. And then these extra little factors, I can then absorb back into a revised quantity for F, which we call the box matrix B. And bringing those little factors around, you can show that this thing now is a Hermitian matrix, even if the U's become imaginary, which can't happen. So we're working not with that F matrix, but this thing called the box matrix. And then with the quantization condition can be written in terms now of the K matrix, or at least this smoothened part of the K matrix times this box matrix. And this is a much easier quantization condition to deal with. Or you can recast it in this way. And you can show that this determinant is real. But that also helps. But it still, of course, involves the determinant of an infinite matrix. So how are we going to make this tractable for getting out the K widths and so on? So there's two things we do. A, we first transform to a slightly different basis, not the JMLS basis, in which we can show that the quantization matrix there will be block diagonal. So then you can just work with the determinants in each block separately. And then the last thing we have to do is truncating the orbital angular momentum. We'll see that it's very rapidly convergent. So what is this block diagonalization? If you take any particular symmetry operation, a rotation or a spatial inversion, say, I can define in this basis this quantity. So this is just basically the rotation generalized to not involve L and S. And this is a weird kind of parity transformation. So if you define this as it's a symmetry, you can show that if you apply this to your box matrix for a particular total momentum P, you will get the box matrix for that symmetry acting on total P. So you don't get the same box matrix back, but you get the box matrix with some other direction of total momentum P. How does that help? Well, if you pick your symmetry operations so that they're in the little group of this P, then of course GP is P, and you can show that those S vectors I defined before stay the same. So basically then this becomes P again. So that matrix commutes with your box matrix for P. So that means you can utilize the eigenvectors of this thing to block diagonalize it. So that's what we do. It's painful, but can be done. So we're going to go from this basis here involving JM, L, and S into a basis that involves JL, S. So basically, we're trading the M sub J for an irrep label, an irrep row, and an occurrence for those irreps. So these are the blocks that it will be diagonal. And you can show that the coefficients to go from one basis to the other depend on J, not on L, but only on minus 1 to the L, and they're independent of S in the channel. And so you write some code to carry this out. So what are those lambdas? Well, they're the symmetry groups of this cubic box. So if you're in zero momentum states, these are basically the different labels. So these are the bosonic labels. These are the fermionic labels. If you have an on-axis momentum, your total momentum is going along the x, y, or z direction, then your little group is C4V, and then these are the labels in that case. We deal with planar diagonals, so if your momentum is going, you know, 1x, 1y, or 1x, 1z, then this is your little group, and cubic diagonal 1, 1, 1, C3V, and you get different labels depending upon what your total momentum is. And so this is just a reminder of the spin content of these things. So I'll just pick one out, say spin 2, for example. It occurs in the E rep and the T2. So this is a one-dimensional, a two-dimensional. These are three-dimensional reps. There's five polarization states. Two of them occur in E, three of them in the T2. T1 is the spin 1, but also you see spin 3, 4, occur in the T1. And these are the fermionic ones. You have half integral spin. The G1 is for our spin 1/2. G2 is 5/2. And then our H has a, so these are two-dimensional ereps. This is a four-dimensional that contains the 3/2 spins and so on. So here's what these basis vectors kind of look like. I'll just flash them quickly. We're going to, you know, let Maple, I actually use Maple. That's from our neighbors next door. Although everyone I know down in the States uses Mathematica, I refuse. Stick with Maple. So you let Maple figure out what all these things are, and it goes on and on, and make tables and tables, these things, blah, blah, blah.
CMU, they should make you use machine language or something, right?
Yeah, I suppose. So now we need what the box matrix and the K matrix looks like in this new basis. And you can show, for example, the box matrix is diagonal in the irrep, in the EREP row, in the total spin, in the channel number. So it's mixing the J, L, and N's, the total angular momentum, the orbital angular momentum, and the occurrence number. And each block can be labeled by these things, block and B. And the K matrix, if you have this, similarly is diagonal in the EREP. Good, so we can block diagonalize the whole thing, the row. Also in the occurrence number and J here, and then you're left with this reduced K matrix. Here's just kind of some of the parameterizations we can use. If we're looking at the inverse of this K matrix, often this can be just well parameterized by polynomials in ECM. If you look at K itself, you can have some background polynomials and some number of poles. So these are where the Bright-Wigners are going to come from. So let me flash you now. So now we've got to take those horrific expressions we had for the box matrix elements and put them in this new basis. So I'll just flash you some tables of that too. In these tables, you'll see some R's and I's. These are shorthand for these zeta functions with some factors in front. And so we've evaluated these things for a large number of L's and S's. You basically spend a month coding this up, testing it like crazy, and then you forget about it. You just let the computer handle these numbers. Not easy. So it kind of looks like this. So this would be the different elements of the box of the J, L, N's, and the primed, the rows in the column. This would be for total P being zero. Each one is some combination of those zeta functions, the real parts. So you get some nice factors. So that's why you don't want to remember these things. This is some more different lambdas. So you have to code all these things up. So you let Maple make the C++ code that does this. All these are total momentum zero. Then still, here's now non-zero momentum, so planar diagonal spin 1/2, starting to get more complicated. At some point you do get some I's in here. Right, so you spend some time coding this up, making it reliable, useful, and I've actually put it on GitHub and people are actually using it, so my hope is that my colleagues don't have to go through all this agony of making this code. They can just utilize it like a black box.
So to use the code, what do you have to provide? Do you have to provide?
Right, so to use the code, it's XML driven, so you have to give it total momentum, the little group, and then you just need to give it the particle masses in terms of some reference scale, the particle spins, how many channels you want, and then you have to give it an L max in each channel. Oh, and you have to tell whether the particles are identical or not. And then it just spits out the matrix. So it automatically sets up the basis. You don't have to worry about it. Evaluates these things, evaluates all the RJLs you need, and so on and so forth. And then if you give it an energy that you've calculated from your lattice simulation, it just pops it in and gives you back that determinant or something that's actually a little more useful. We call it the omega function. So you take your determinant. So this will be 1 minus KB or KB, K inverse minus B. You stick it into here. So you get a function that has the same zeros for the determinant, but determinants can be very difficult to deal with numerically. I mean, they can be very large or very small.
I'm losing the thread of, so where do you put in what the dynamics is that you're solving? So, because I got lost in all the matrices now. So here you're putting in the particle types, but how do I tell them how they're interacting with each other?
You're not telling them how they interact with each other. That comes from the lattice simulation that gives you these interacting energies.
I think I'm completely lost. So
it's complicated.
So what's the system we're talking about here now? So
well, I'll show you some examples. For example, let's look at the row. Okay. So you know it decays to pi pi.
Okay.
So we're going to then get all the pi pi energies in our boxes.
Okay. But the thing is, in all your graphs, at some point you have to tell the computer what the vertices were in those graphs, right?
No.
So no. I'm confused at this. It's at a really basic level where you had to tell the computer what theory you're finding these energies for, right?
You just have to tell it this information here. That's all. Don't need to know anything more about the dynamics.
I think QCD or chiral perturbation theory or whatever will enter in the calculation of this E as a
right.
function of L.
All the dynamics will go into what these E's are. I don't know what they are. That's the thing we have to compute with our lattice simulation. So QCD will tell us what the allowed E's are.
And this is still finite size, right?
Right. We do our lattice simulations in finite volume. So we're going to get out discrete energies, not going to get a continuum of energies. So it'll tell us what E's are. And then we take those E's and just plug them in to all this machinery and look for the zeros of those determinants. Yeah, it's complicated. Yes?
Is it accurate to say you provide energies and this piece of software turns the energies into bound states or into, what does it output?
It outputs that different things. If you're gonna, one method is to say, put in the parameters. So the end thing you're fitting are the parameters of the K matrix. So you can input the parameters for the K matrix, evaluate the K matrix, and this thing will tell you what the spectrum should look like. So all the dynamics is in the K matrix, right? It's the scattering matrix. So if you knew what it was, you could put that in, and it'll tell you what the E's should be based on this quantization condition. So what we do then is, well, we see how do these E's match to what we found in QCD? They don't match. Well, then we got our K matrix parameters wrong. So you start adjusting the K matrix parameters so that the spectrum you get out matches the spectrum you found from lattice QCD. So that's basically what's going on. So the end thing you're getting out is that K matrix. So what the vertices and all that, that's what produces the K matrix. So I mean, we could then say, well, what effective theory could I write down that would have produced that K matrix? Then you could take it a step further and do that. Right. Another approach is to, which we use, is we take these energies and put them in, and what is the determinant you get out for a given set of K matrix parameters, but you still have to fiddle with the K matrix parameters to perform a fit. So it's just, what is the thing that you're minimizing? What's the chi squared? So it can be the spectrum itself, the different energies, or this determinant itself. It will go to zero if you get the K matrix parameters correct. If you don't, you'll get some other determinant value, so the chi squared's much larger, so you always have to very minimize with respect to the K-matrix parameters to get this to match up. Now, of course, this is if you have multiple partial waves, multiple decay channels, you have to do it this way. If you just have one channel and one partial wave, you can actually solve this. I mean, the determinant is just a function, so you can get the phase shift directly. And I'll show you some cases where we get the phase shift directly. So these things, just through this single channel case, single wave, will give you the phase shift direct. So what's crucial here is being able to get these interacting energies reliably. And that's what's changed over the past 5 years or so. Back in the 80s, when Lucier came up with this method, there was no hope of getting these energies accurately enough. And it's basically because these are two-particle interacting energies. So you need good operators to produce two-particle states.
It's only for two-body decays or this?
Right, yes. If you get higher and you need three-particle, you go above three-particle, four-particle thresholds, it's much, much more complicated. People are working on it, and it's an active area of research. I don't see myself going into that part. I didn't think I would go into this, but I kind of got dragged in. That's another story. But it's been interesting. So I mentioned this already. So I can define this thing as my chi-squared, as my residuals in my chi-squared. But it always boils down to minimization of these parameters in the K matrix, and then utilizing this quantization to tell me which ones produce the spectrum I'm observing in my lattice QCD calculations. So how do I get those lattice QCD energies? So I'll just give a couple of slides on this. And this is a whole industry in itself that's developed over decades. So if you can't follow it, don't worry. I'm just giving you a couple of slides outlining on how we do this. And it's very, very complicated and requires lots of computer time on supercomputing systems. But it basically boils down to the following. We deduce our energies from temporal correlations of various operators. So you design some number of operators that you think are going to be good at creating the states you're interested in. So if you want a pi-pi state or a rho, you need a rho or a pi-pi kind of operator. Then you let it propagate for some time and annihilate it. So that's your temporal correlations. And we'll need not just ground states, but excited states. That's another reason why we weren't able to do it in the 80s. Getting excited states was not possible at that time. So you make n of these operators, so you form an n by n correlation matrix. So a lot of what's changed is knowing what are the good operators to put in and actually being able to evaluate the correlation functions, because you'll see why it's hard in a second. So the QCD action has this form. There's a purely gluonic part. So these U's are the glue field, and then it involves the quark, anti-quark field with some matrix interaction between them that depends on the gauge field. So this is a very large matrix. These being grasped and valued, we integrate. We can't do those integrals by computer. We actually evaluate those exactly, but we can because it appears quadratically here. But we end up with determinants of K and inverses of K. And that's the problem, because these are very large matrices. So this is the ratio of path integrals we need to do to get these correlation functions. So we do the integrals over the grasp and field, and then the last integrals over the gauge fields are done with the Monte Carlo method. We work, as you see, in imaginary time here so that this is real and positive. So it can be utilized, interpreted as a probability, making it possible to do Monte Carlo. And also the spectral representation of these things are not in terms of oscillatory factors as you would have in Minkowski space, but decaying exponentials. So pulling out the energies from the spectral decomposition of these things is feasible. So on the quarks reside on it's a space-time lattice. We're discretizing in both space and time. So the quarks reside on the sites, and the links between them are these gluon fields. So Ken Wilson, back in the early 70s, figured out how to put non-abelian field theories on a lattice like this without violating local gauge symmetries. So basically, these are path-ordered exponentials of the field. So if you look at one of those correlation matrices, you can show that it should have this spectral representation. So technically, all the discrete energy levels are in these functions. but with overlap factors for each of the states. These overlap factors. But of course, you know, there's an infinite number of these things. How are you going to get out those energy levels? So the goal here is to get out the energy levels here. Now you could just say, well, why can't I just do one correlator, do it for a large enough number of times, and then I could probably figure out what all these exponentials were. No, you can't do that. Won't work. There's not enough information, and we're evaluating this thing in Monte Carlo, so there's statistical errors. And typically the errors grow very quickly with time. So you're only going to have access to some limited amount of times. Yes?
The IJs are lattice.
These IJs refer to the different operators you're using.
And so what, would that label a particle or would that label?
It could. It could be different. For example, here it will be different 2-pion operators. Oh. So 2-pions at rest, 2-pions with back-to-back momenta, 2-pions with off-axis, planar diagonal ones, K-bar states. So you make a whole bunch of these things and let them interact. Right. And if you pick a crappy operator, these overlaps are small. So then it takes a large time to really see the lowest lying states. And so typically what happens is you never do. The error grows in the statistics, so you never get to a point where you can actually pull out the lowest lying energies. So most of the work in the past decades has been going into building operators that maximize these overlaps. So it's nice in the sense that, you know, you're putting the physics in. You're trying to build an operator that believe produces the state you want as well as possible. And we've gotten very good at that. And the system kind of tells you how to do it. If you do it badly, you'll see it in plotting these things out. Wow, that's way up there. It'll never get down to where I think it needs to be. And in fact, how do you get out these energies? Well, you have an n by n matrix, you could say, well, let me look at the eigenvalues of that n by n matrix. And you could utilize those eigenvalues to get the n by n. So you can get the n lowest states. You can prove that you can get the n lowest state. But it's actually not a very good way of doing it. It's better to actually formulate this bizarre sequence of matrices. So you don't analyze this correlator matrix itself. You do this new one that has basically a clever way of utilizing the matrix itself to find a matrix that's much more diagonal. And so we actually utilize this. So you pick some T-naught, and there's some artistry to how you're picking the T-naught and this diagonalization time. But basically, you can show that this thing behaves much more diagonal. I'll show you in a toy example how this works. Here's sort of how it works. So if I just pick a toy model, here's a whole bunch of these. So I picked a toy model that had 200 states. So I've got 12 operators. And if you look at the 12 by 12 matrix, here are the eigen. So here are the correlators themselves. And here would be the eigenvalues of those 12 by 12. And I know from, you know, because this is a toy model I made, these are the exact eigenvalues. You can see that, you know, this lowest one is trying to go where it's supposed to. But all these others are really taking their sweet time to get to the exact energies where they should. So the eigenvalues themselves is not a good thing to utilize. But if you utilize the eigenvalues of that other matrix, here's a plot of them. Can see that. So basically, you're finding a new basis utilizing orthogonality. You know, so this guy is the best thing it could be. In fact, if you look at the math involved, it's like a variational technique. What's the combination you get here is basically the best operator that will give you the state, and it gets there very quickly. And all these other levels are built orthogonal to this one, so they have nowhere to go but to the lowest first excited state, and so on. So this is how you get n levels. Utilizing a matrix of correlators. Of course, you've got to have very good overlap with all these states to get here. If you miss one or two, you're going to be way up there. So it's a whole, we've spent decades figuring out the best way of making these operators. So I'll just give you a quick rundown. We need to make lots of operators, so we need to find some, you know, neat Lego block that we can use to build all these things. And so covariantly smeared quarks fields are what we use, and we smear in a very special way. I'm running out of time, so I'll skip this. But if you have questions, I can go over, you know, well, how do you build these operators? Basically, we found the optimal way of smearing these fields to get rid of excited state contamination, the higher lying stuff we don't want, and displacing them in ways so that we could build up radial and orbital structures of all the resonances we're after, and do it in a very efficient way. The big thing that's been, so here's kind of what the meson type operators look like and our baryon operators. And they've got to be projected. These are all different rotated, and they've got to be projected onto the ear reps of the lattice symmetry group. So it's a lot of work, but doable, two particle operators. So the big problem with doing these kinds of decay calculations is you need to get the energies of these two particle states. So the hardest part in all of this is dealing with, after you do the Grassmann integration, you're going to end up with a determinant of K and also these K inverses. So for example, on a 32 cubed by 256 lattice, one of the smaller ones we use, this is a 100 million by 100 million matrix. You can't even store the things. And you've got to calculate lots of these inverses. So how are you going to do this? In the old days of just single particle operators, you could utilize translational invariance. You could just, at the source, say, oh, I don't need to sum over all the sources. Every site for the source, I know this element that I'm evaluating is invariant under translation, so let me just pick one site. So you do a point to all, and that worked very well. The problem with when you want to do two particles is you cannot get rid of all those source inverse, K inverses. For example, here's a two particle operator. You're going to need a line like this. And these things are, you know, summed over all the spaces, spatial sites at this time. You can't just say, well, let me put this one at a single site, because you're going to need to evaluate those from everywhere to everywhere. And similarly, especially here at the sink, you need these kind of lines. So you need to go from all points here to all points there. So you're getting into a situation where you can't use this point-to-all trick. And that was a real stumbling block for a long time. Now, even with isoscalar kind of particles, you need diagrams like that.
So this five-quark thing, it would be like a delta decay or something?
Right. So this would be a meson, a nucleon pion, for example. I'll show you some results for the delta. So we came up with this thing called the stochastic Laff method that's made us able to do these kinds of diagrams. I don't want to go into the details, but basically we found a way of approximating these K inverses in a Monte Carlo within a Monte Carlo. And this is the very basic way you would do it in Monte Carlo, but it's way too noisy. But we found this clever way of using projectors and variance reduction to get a modified Monte Carlo that has a statistical enough accuracy to get these energy levels. So that's been another big thing here. We can now evaluate, so this is just details. So you have to, you know, you let the computer do all this, but another nice feature of this method is it actually allows us to factorize the correlators into a source function and a sink function, so that if you want to do a whole bunch of operators, you just make them, and then you can do the n by n very efficiently. So it had a nice side effect. So let me show you some results, because 5 minutes left, right? That's in like an hour. So here's some results from, basically we want to know how does the rho meson decay? So these are pi isovector energies in finite volume. So for example, so this column here, so these are energy levels with statistical errors. So this is d squared equals 0. So this is the at-rest channel, total zero momentum in the T1, it's hard to see, in the T1U. So that's the spin 1 channel for the rho. So we get these three energy levels. So these are center of mass energies divided by a reference mass, which we use as the pion. And this is just giving you information about the structure of each level. This is a rho operator. This is a pi operator with 1 unit of momentum in each direction, 2 units. So that's a 1, 1, 3, 3. So it's telling you that this lowest state here really likes the rho operator and a fair bit of the pi-pi, as you would expect they interact. And that this one up here is mostly pi-pi with 2 units. So these energies would be the energies you get if you have 1 unit of total momentum. Doesn't matter the direction. In the A1 irrep, the little group, this is a 1 unit of momentum in the E rep. This is would be a so d squared of 2, a 1, 1 direction total momentum in the A1, the B1, just different blocks of this quantization condition. This is d squared 3, 1, 1, 1 direction. D squared 4 here, that would be 2 units in one direction, 0, 0 the other direction. So this is what comes out of your lattice calculation, these energy levels. So these are the energies that then go into that quantization condition. So what K matrix is producing this is what you're answering. What K matrix gives me that spectrum in this finite volume?
And the width of those things are?
The statistical errors. Yeah, so that's basically a non-determination. We wouldn't use it, for example. It's got a higher momentum. So here's the functional forms we used. So we used the K inverse form. So we're going to put in a P wave. This is the P wave Breit-Wigner. So our parameters determined are the masses. So the energies go in, but we get the masses from other simulations. So it's basically this G here, this coupling, that's given us the width. The L equal 3 wave, so just treating that as a constant, so that would be a scattering length, although the units are slightly different. And then we have an L equal 5 wave here, another constant. So if we do utilize this form for K inverse, then this is what we get in our fit. So this would be the mass of the rho, the mass of the rho resonance over the pion mass. And this would be giving us the width. So experimentally, this is 6. So we kind of got very close to the experimental. This does not match the experiment because we're working at a pion mass that's 240. Just so it took 3 years to do this calculation, not 30 years. Although we can now work at the physical point. Let's mention that in a second. But from when we did this starting 5 years ago, that's what we did. So here's like a plot of the, so this is the a QCM over m pi to the third cotan of the P wave scattering phase shift. And here's the phase shift itself, the argon diagram for that, and the sine squared, which is basically the scattering cross section. So we can actually see the decay of the rho. So was there a question?
Sorry, what was that outlier there?
This outlier? Probably it's more with we've only taken that form for the K matrix. So it's probably telling us in this particular channel, the diamond here, in D squared, we probably needed another wave to get that to fall in line. At one point, he may or may not have been used in the fit. Can't remember. So that's for the rho decay. But the point here is we're actually getting infinite volume decay information from just these finite volume interacting energy levels. I think it's pretty cool.
Thank you, Martin and Lucia.
This is just to show you the that the L equal 3 and the L equal 5 waves are consistent with zero. So the truncation in L is very effective here. And if this had not been, you know, you'd have to include L equals 7 and so on. If I run out of time, I'll let me flash the K pi. So this is for the K star 892. How does it decay? So again, this is what comes out of the lattice simulations, the spectrum in finite volume for different total momentum of the K pi system. So the question is, what K matrix is giving me that spectrum? So a similar kind of fit, although here, because they're not identical particles, you have a D wave, and there's also an S wave. So the S wave will give us kappa information. It's a very bizarre resonance structure, so we took a variety of different forms. I mean, we try all sorts of different forms. So here's basically what we find for the, here's the P wave phase shift, some information on the S wave. So we did actually find a Bright-Wigner type kappa, but that's probably because it's Bright-Wigner probably because we're at this heavier pion mass comparison. Oh, here's our delta. So this was the first baryon resonance ever done this way, and we're drastically improving on this. I mean, the baryon meson systems are much harder, much noisier. So the fact that we saw anything at all, so this is again the cotan of the P wave with the centrifugal factor in there, and you see it crosses zero where the resonance is. Other future work. So future work will be to go to larger lattices, and we're actually working at the physical point now. God knows how long that'll take, but we got computer time to start those runs. And we're also coded up some bizarre operators called tetraquarks. That's the next thing we want to look at, is how much of this spectrum, in particular weird objects like the kappa, how well does the tetraquark operator doing creating that kind of resonance? So tetraquark, you get a quark quark and an antiquark antiquark and some strange color structure. Kind of. So to summarize, this Lucia formulation allows us to relate infinite volume scattering information to the finite volume energies. And it was developed in the 80s and further later, but we weren't able to utilize it because we couldn't get the energies out. But now we have enough computer power and new techniques to do two-particle and three-particle energies accurately enough. And so we and some other groups are now starting to look at these decays. So I showed you the rho to pi pi and the K star and the delta. But we're intending on continuing these and some other systems to work at more physical pion masses. And it's just starting work with tetraquark operators. Thank you. Yes.
So perhaps the most interesting for phenology decay is the weak decay of CAN to two pions, right? And then a few years ago, there were claims that this decay was totally calculated by lattice QCD, but I don't remember them going through the pains that you have shown.
Yeah, typically they would have just evaluated certain matrix elements back.
That's correct. So, and I heard the statements by more phenomenology folks that we need to take into account pi pi rescattering as the CAN decays, and that should change results, right? And in your method, it's they understand that by virus gathering is being taken
right.
care that, of.
That's all in
right.
Right.
So is there any hope in the future of applying this to the KDK, right?
Our group are not working on that personally, but and the people that I know, I have not told me that they're working on that. I don't know of anyone working on that, but that not everyone tells me what they're working on.
Yeah, no, maybe.
So I wouldn't be surprised if someone's not working.
Maybe I misunderstand, but this, I mean, like delta decays and so on. It's all nice, but it's not. I mean, for bigger picture of particle physics, it's not very, you know, it's not as consequential as K255.
Right. Certainly, what makes this more doable is we have decay widths that are large. What makes it easier?
Well,
I mean, you don't want them to be too large, but
the Fermi is such that it's not tiny, right? You can still subtract that out.
Right.
I guess.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if someone's working on it. And I might even know who. Yes. Do you know who?
Yeah. So the ABC, so Norman Christian Company. So they have the 5.5 phase shift to 5.5.
So. Some following something like this?
Yeah, they're much more rudimentary. I mean, they're using this formalism, but not using the real-life basis of operators. So if they were trying to get the rho channel, they would be hopeless. But because they're interested in I equals 0, I equals 2 pi pi, which are not resonant in these energy ranges, it's sort of probably okay, is my feeling, right? I think that's... And it's in a very limited kinematic range. But they definitely evaluate 2 pi on energies in their boxes. And so for the one particle to two particle, there's another version of this method, which is called the Lelouch-Lusher form. The two particle piece of that. So this is sort of 2000.
Did you investigate spin zero pi phase shift?
We have done. The other ones we've done are the I equal 2 pi. I mean, that's not so interesting, but it's just kind of low-hanging fruit. We haven't done any isoscalar. We kind of dabbled a little bit in isoscalars. That's a lot noisier. So for pi, that's all we've done personally. We're more focused on, we would like to apply this to trying to see if things like the Roper are feasible with this method. There's some very strange resonances out there that people are very puzzled by, Roper being one of them. So that's more what we have our eye on. Yes?
Is there a special reason why you're on a cubic lattice?
So cubic, lattice, and L cubed, or just a
cubic lattice as opposed to hexagonal close pack, for example?
Right. These simulations are very expensive. So someone spends hundreds of millions of hours generating the Monte Carlo lattices. And so the hypercubic is just what people find the easiest to use.
Right.
And when you generate these things, to get the computer time to do it, you have to basically show that many people use them. And so the hypercubic is just the easiest. And that's the one that we're most familiar with. We know that it's normalizable and you don't run into any funny things. Yeah, I'm always asked about what about other lattice structures. Yeah, it would be great if somebody could do it, but and nobody's really gambled enough to do it. Within the hypercubic, people do not L cubed, but they could do L squared by some other L. That's another way of getting around having to do different total momentum to get more points on these phase shifts. But I think the total momentum method is actually more feasible. So L cubed is what there's more symmetries related to it, especially when you get into the fermions. I mean, you get down to one-dimensional irreps in it. You get lots of different spins talking to other spins, and it gets nasty. You want to try to get as clean as possible.
Any other questions? Let's thank Colin one more time.
Thanks.